Hello. I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Come right over. Chair by the window. Comfortable?
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Shemini. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 4th day of April. Oh, I shouldn't tell you that first. The 24th day of Nisan, which corresponds to the 4th day of April. And it's very, very hard, at least for me, for some reason, getting back into the track here after Pesach. Had a lot of things going on over Pesach, a lot of things coming up this Shabbat, including the bar mitzvah of my eldest grandson, Devir Moshe Schler. So a mazel tov to him and the whole family. And where do we begin? I told you the date, but I didn't tell you that we counted 9 days in the Omer last night. We said, this is for Thursday, Hayom tish'a yamim shehem shavua echad u'shnei yamim la'omer. If you haven't counted last night, you should repeat those words even during the day, but without a bracha. A bracha. Tehillim Kuf Kaf Aleph, Psalm 121. Shir Hama'alot, Esa Einai El Heharim, Me'ayin Yavo Ezri. Ezri Me'im Adonai, Osei Shamayim Va'aretz. Al Yitain Lamot Raglecha, Al Yanum Shomerecha. Hine Lo Yanum V'lo Yishan Shomer Yisrael. Adonai Shomerecha, Adonai Tzilecha, Al Yad Yaminecha. Yomam Hashemesh Lo Yakeka V'yoreach Balayla. Adonai Yishmorcha Mikol Ra Yishmor Et Nafshecha. Adonai Yishmor Tzeitecha Uvoecha Me'ata V'ad Olam. Achinu Kol Beit Yisrael Hanatunim Batzara Uvashivya. Ha'omedim Bein Bayam Uvein Bayabasha. Hamakom Yirachim Aleihem V'yotziyem Mitzara Lirvacha U'me'afela La'ora U'mishibud L'geula. Hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. I also haven't told you yet, but I will right now, that this Shabbat we bench Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh Iyar will be Wednesday and Thursday, this coming Wednesday and Thursday. The announcement will be Rosh Chodesh Iyar hiye b'yom revi'i uv'yom chamishi haba aleinu v'al kol Yisrael litova. The Molad is Wednesday night, and what else you have to know, just go to shul and you'll hear the rest. Okay, where to begin? I really, you'll have to be patient with me, I have to get back into it. So much so to the point that last Thursday came and went, and to me it wasn't Thursday, it was a day of Chol HaMoed, and the question of doing a show or not doing a show didn't pop into my mind even. Today, Thursday, somebody said to me, what do you usually do on Wednesday, on Thursday? I didn't remember to say I record my show. Very, very weird. So I imagine many of the listeners also have had trouble getting back into their routine if they've been away for Pesach. And that's the story. So where do we begin? Before we take a look at Parshat Shemini, I want to mention that the 27th of Nisan is usually designated as Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura, a Holocaust Memorial Day, Remembrance Day. This year in Israel, it is pushed to Monday, the 8th of April, beginning on Sunday evening, the 7th. And this was done in order to avoid possible desecration of the Shabbat in jumping the gun on Saturday night to set up for programs that take place on Motzoi Shabbat. So instead, they just pushed it a day ahead. And I don't know how this affects other places in the world where Yom HaShoah is marked, whether they follow the lead of Israel or not. And since there's no religious significance to the day per se, that's not a problem. The following week will be more interesting, and that's because Yom HaAtzma'ut and Yom HaZikaron, IDF Memorial Day, are each advanced a day, not advanced, pushed off a day, again for the same problem. Yom HaZikaron has ceremonies at night and during the day. The ceremonies at night by the regular calendar would be Saturday night, right after Shabbat, to avoid possible Chilul Shabbat, desecration of the Shabbat. Yom HaAtzma'ut was moved from the 5th of Iyar to the 6th, from Monday the 15th of April to Tuesday the 16th, and Yom HaZikaron is automatically the day before, which means it begins on Sunday night and goes through Monday day. There, the halachic ramifications for those who observe the day as a religious holiday is the reciting of Hallel and many other things that go along with it. But most, let's call us Dati Lu'umi, the religious Zionist community, follow the lead of the Knesset, and officially Yom HaAtzma'ut can float, and especially since the motive of the float was to avoid desecration of the Shabbat, the religious community should be extra appreciative of that. The country had a choice. They could have moved their national marking of the days, both Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzma'ut, and let the religious day stay where it was. That would cause a sad split within the community, and I am glad that they went in the direction of avoiding desecration of the Shabbat, and the religious community went along with that and said, okay, we will celebrate this year the establishment of the State of Israel, 65 years, on Tuesday the 6th of Iyar instead of the usual Hey Iyar. And I really shouldn't say usual because it gets bumped when it falls on Monday to Tuesday. It gets pulled back when it falls on Shabbat to Thursday. It gets pulled back when it's Friday to Thursday. So I have to do the statistics again, but it could be more often that it's bumped than it is on its day that it originally was intended. The irony there is that the state was declared on Friday afternoon, Hey Iyar, fifth day of Iyar, and since Yom HaAtzma'ut, whenever it falls on Friday, is pulled back to Thursday, we never celebrate Yom HaAtzma'ut on the day of the week that it actually occurred and the state was established. All right, enough of that. 2 weeks to go, although it feels like much more, was Parshat Tzav, Shabbat HaGadol, and then came the first day of Pesach, and in Chutz Laaretz, the second day of Pesach, meaning holiday, and Yom Tov, and then Shabbat Chol HaMoed for everybody, and then the seventh day, which ended Pesach for us in Israel, and the eighth day, which people around the world keep. And now we're coming up to a Shabbat. So we had 1 week postponement of Parshat HaShavua, special reading on Shabbat Chol HaMoed, which delays the continuation of the weekly portion. But again, it feels like much more. So here's the first pasuk. Vayehi bayom hashemini kara Moshe li Aharon ulvanav ulziknei Yisrael. It was on the eighth day that Moshe summoned Aharon and his sons and the elders of Israel. The eighth day, famous question, eighth day of what? The eighth day of the inauguration of the Mishkan, the tabernacles. There was a seven-day period of inauguration, and on the eighth day, the Mishkan kicked into regular full operation for the first time. The very first sacrifice that the Torah describes of this eighth day, setting the tone for the Mishkan, is an egel, a calf, and it's brought by Aharon the Kohen Gadol, and it is unavoidable to see the connection between this use of a calf and the horrifying, totally inappropriate, wrong use of the golden calf, even though that was quite a number of weeks ago that we read it, it still sequentially led up to this moment when the damage was repaired or in the process of repair, and that Aaron, who was somewhat involved, the Torah calling it the Egel Asher Asa Aharon, and the Egel combine to start this new era, which continues and occasionally is interrupted by exile and continues and eventually will be restored to go on forever, that it starts with an Egel. Okay, after the description of the sacrifices, and I should say the following, maybe I'll say it now. Parshat Vayikra, Parshat Tzav, and the first part of Shmini all deal with various and sundry sacrifices in the Beit HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, in the Mikdash. Towards the end of the Parsha, we finally get to the portion about the animals we're allowed to eat and we're not allowed to eat. And commentaries have pointed out the following. When it comes to the topic of human use of animals, we first have service of God. At God's command, there are daily sacrifices, extra ones on Shabbat and Chagim, special occasions, sin offerings, a whole variety of korbanot, where God is saying, you have my permission and blessing to take from the animal world these animals for sacrifices in the religious, spiritual service of God in the temple. Obviously, I would say it goes without saying, but unfortunately it doesn't go without saying, one needs to remember that no sacrifice and nothing else external has any value unless the person and the people feel it in their heart, understand what's going on, and have the right intentions to repent when it comes to a sin offering and other variations of that in different situations. So don't get sidetracked down the road of the ritual. The ritual is hollow and empty and shallow without the person's heart and soul into it. After two and a third sedras, weekly portions of korbanot, then the Torah is ready to say, and speaking of animals, these are the animals you are allowed to eat, and these are the ones you're not allowed to eat. And the same thing for fish, and the same thing for birds, and the same thing for insects. This idea has a parallel from the beginning of the world. We have this concept that no human beings had permission by God to eat meat from creation onward until the time of Noah. Noah, when he came out of the Teva, out of the ark, offered sacrifices to God. At that point, as if God said to him, you see, the primary use of animals is sacrifices to me, which make you better people. Now you have my permission to eat meat, except that the animal has to be killed first, and a whole bunch of et cetera. This idea also shows up in Mishnah, the Talmud, the embodiment of the oral law. Seder Kodashim, the fifth book of the Mishnah, the fifth volume, begins with Zevachim, animal sacrifices, Minachot, offerings to God from the plant world, flour, barley and wheat, oil, olive oil, various spices. And now, after you have the study of Zevachim and Minachot, now you can get to the volume called Chulin. Chulin has the laws of ritual slaughter and many other topics of ma'achalot, asurot, permitted, forbidden, and permitted foods and procedures, as if to say the same thing for a third time. First and foremost, you have to realize the role animals play in temple service. Then, if you understand that and appreciate that, then you're able to go take a cow and not offer it as an offering to God, but to slaughter it properly and to prepare its meat properly and to enjoy the bounty of this world. The Torah continues. These sacrifices were all prepared, and to initiate the functioning of the altar, the Mizbeach, the Torah tells us, Vateitze Eish Milifnei Hashem. A fire went forth from before God and consumed upon the altar the elevation offering and the fats. The people saw and sang glad song and fell upon their faces. Vayarch kol ha'am vayaronu vayiplu al pneihem. Then we have, in the middle of this festive inauguration and very spiritual high of the Mishkan, we have a tragedy. Vayikru v'nei Aharon, two of the sons of Aharon, namely Nadav and Avihu, each took a fire pan, and they put fire in it and placed incense upon it, and they brought before Hashem an alien fire that he had not commanded them. The previous verse said that the fire came from God. They struck their own matches or whatever, and they made an offering in zealous attempt to serve God, but they didn't follow procedure. And they were struck dead. A very harsh punishment, a very harsh lesson for Aaron, for Nadav and Avihu's brothers, Elazar and Itamar, and for all of the people of Israel. You have to follow the rules, especially in the temple. I'm not sure how that sounded. You have to follow the rules all the time, but the stakes are higher in temple service. Just to use a totally different example, but it's something that I try to imagine and use to focus. A Kohen is required to wash his hands and his feet before doing temple service. If he does it without washing his hands and feet in the special prescribed way, he is liable to a death penalty from heaven. We are required to wash our hands ritually upon waking in the morning and before meals with bread. Our punishment for not doing that is nowhere near a death penalty from heaven. But one needs to imagine as if it were. Can you imagine that a relatively minor transgression could be a capital offense before God? No humans are going to form a court and bring someone up on charges of improper washing of his hands. If we are talking about God who makes rules and God who commanded us to follow the dictates of the sages as well, then it's within his power and within maybe his, quote, best interest to punish strictly and swiftly anyone who violates. And we can't say this is not fair. His answer would be, what do you mean it's not fair? I created the world and you too, and I commanded you to do something. You didn't do it. Zap, you're gone. But God doesn't work like that, thankfully, and we should be very appreciative of that. But we should also be mindful of the fact that it is an act of kindness on God's part not to hold us with that highest level of accountability. This goes to the core of the issue of God in his strict judge mode and God in his rachamim, merciful mode. Human beings cannot function if God would play the strictest judge of us. Because you do one thing wrong that he didn't tell you, zap, you're gone. There is no justification to existence unless you listen to God. So how do we all survive day after day, even with doing the wrong things? Act of mercy on God's part, and we should be appreciative of it. If you notice, I got sidetracked a little, and now coming back to Nadav and Avihu, we don't see God's mercy in action. We see strict punishment for bringing a strange fire into the temple. It has to come from the Mizbeach. The original fire of the Mizbeach came from God himself. And it is an eternal flame. Okay, what follows then is in the midst of Aharon's tragedy of losing two sons, we have several rules that are set down for the proper behavior of Kohanim. And it's not a matter of closing the barn door after the horse is stolen, but this is the context into which these mitzvot, which came from Sinai, are transmitted to us in the Torah. Hold those thoughts. We'll be right back with more Torah Tidbits Audio. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Shemini, and we were just talking about the rules regulating Kohanim and their behavior in the Mikdash in context of the tragic deaths of Nadav and Avihu. I don't know if I made myself clear. Mitzvot in the Torah were all given by God to Moshe at Sinai, and he transmitted them to the people in the course of the 40 years of wandering in the Midbar. The Torah presents us with mitzvot, often in context where it wants us to learn something from the connection. So it's unavoidable to read about the deaths of Nadav and Avihu for bringing a strange fire into the temple. And then, after the aftermath of that, and God said to Aharon, saying, for example, do not drink intoxicating wine, you and your sons with you, when you come to the tent of meeting, the Ohel Moed, that you not die. This is an eternal decree for your generations in perpetuity. Now, this, again, is part of Torah from Sinai, but the Torah presents it for all future generations in juxtaposition to the story of Nadav and Avihu. Commentaries speculate, perhaps, they had entered the temple to offer service intoxicated. We don't know for sure, but we are convinced, let's say, of the seriousness of drinking before temple service, because it says, "Velo tamutu, you shall not die." And chukat olam means this is in perpetuity. On this note, let me digress, but not really digress, for something that I've said in the past, but it always brings a smile to my face, and it's important to know the background. One of the 613 mitzvot, one of the 365 of 613, which are prohibitions, is the prohibition of a kohen offering, doing any service in the temple while having recently drunk wine or other intoxicating beverage. Now this happens to have, I'm going off on a tangent from the tangent now, this has a practical application today that results in the fact that on Simchat Torah, many, many communities do not have the Kohanim Dochen, bless the people, in the usual slot at the end of Musaf repetition. Because by the time you get to Musaf repetition on Simchat Torah, you have made Kiddush and imbibed in wine, in whiskey, and not appropriate for a Kohen to do service, of which Birchat Kohanim is a remnant of temple service, which is still done today. And therefore, I remember in the States, they used to bless the people at Shacharit, before the Hakafot, before Kiddush, and not at Musaf. Here in Israel, where Kohanim duchen every day, and twice on Shabbat and Yom Tov, and three times on Yom Kippur, here, many Kohanim do not want to give up the Birchat Kohanim of Musaf, even on Simchat Torah, and instead they will either use grape juice or be yotze from somebody else and not have that problem to avoid, to knock out the Birchat Kohanim. So that's just one ramification of this particular prohibition. But I wanted to address another issue. Sefer Achinuch and other sources tell us that this specific prohibition has another application from the Torah, not by rabbinic extension, but by oral tradition, that this prohibition of drinking wine and being prohibited to do temple service or vice versa applies also to a halachic authority rendering a decision of halacha. They tell the story that Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem many years ago, would start his Pesach Seder very, very late. Because he says, if I start the Seder on regular time, I will have the first cup of wine, and invariably someone will knock on the door with an important question to ask. Is this matzah acceptable because it's bent here, or it's broken, or it's not broken, or how do I fix it, how do I use it, I don't have afikomen, whatever. They will ask halachic questions, and I won't be able to render answers, because I will have drunk a cup of wine recently. Therefore, he used to wait before he started his seder, until all of the typical questions that came to the rabbi were already asked. So that's an application of this prohibition, which, as I said, Sefer Achinuch says, it's a Torah prohibition for a posek, halachic authority, to render halachic decision while under the influence of alcohol. Exactly its parameters, I don't know. I do know that a Dvar Torah, an analysis of a verse or something like that, can be done even if you're drunk. Not if you are drunk, but if you have drunk wine. But not a halachic decision. The interesting thing in Sefer Achinuch is, he writes like this, and this mitzvah, the prohibition of rendering a halachic decision before you drink, having drunk, This mitzvah applies in all times and all places, meaning not just the time of the temple, as the first application of this prohibition would be. It applies in all times and all places to men and to women who are authorized to render halachic decisions. That means that the Sefer HaChinuch, 800 years ago, recognized that women can also be poskim. A woman who is learned and recognized as authoritative can render a halachic decision. That's not quite your female rabbi, but close. Depends on how you define rabbi, which is not the point now. The point is, you can have a poseket halacha, just like you can have a posek. And in fact, there are women's schools in Israel that, and very, very tough exams to be certified, who qualify women for rendering halachic decisions in certain areas, most prominently those of marital relations and the tumat nida and things like that, because women with these questions are sometimes embarrassed to go to a male rabbi. So now that you have a program and certification of women to render decisions that are considered halachically binding, women have another woman to go to ask their questions. I don't think it's gone too much further than that, but there is no reason why women can't be authorized and trained and then authorized to render decisions about Shabbat and about Kashrut and about every area of Halacha. Sefer HaChinuch, 800 years ago, well before his time. I want to now move to the other part of the Sedra towards the end, which, as I mentioned earlier, contains the business of kashrut of animals. reminds me of the song we used to sing, all the animals that we eat must chew their cud and have split feet. I'm a Jew and I'm not faking. No, that's a can't. Throw away the pork and bacon. I'm a Jew and I'm not faking. Kosher meat, whatever. I don't remember the song. If you do, fine. Sing it. But this is where it comes from. There are two places in the Torah that have the laws of kosher and non-kosher animal. One is the end of Shmini and the other is the end of Re'eh. With differences. Not differences in practical side, but some textual differences. So here we have the following. And God spoke to Moshe and to Aaron, saying to them, Dabaru el b'nei Yisrael limor, speak to the people of Israel and tell them, Zot hachaya asher tochalu, mikol habehema asher al haaretz. These are the animals which you may eat from among all the animals that there are. These are the creatures that you may eat from among all the animals that are upon the earth. It starts with mammal, and this is known, well known. Animal has to have split hoofs, and it has to chew its cud. That's a ruminant, even-toed ruminant with a split hoof. And ungulate, I think, is the word that's used also for that type of animal. And those are kosher. Then the Torah proceeds to give four examples of animals, three of which do not chew their cud, even though they have a split hoof. I'm sorry, the opposite. Three animals among the four that chew their cud but do not have a split hoof. The one that's known to be identified among these is the camel, which chews its cud but doesn't have a split hoof. The other two are the Shafan and Arnevet, and there's interesting discussion and debate as to which animals they were. Some define them as hare and rabbit. Others refuse to define them because we don't know and because hares and rabbits do not actually chew their cud, although they do something very similar. Be that as it may, the shafan, the anivet, and the gamal are the three animals that are declared as not kosher because they are missing one of the two signs. The chazir, the pig, is the fourth animal which is mentioned, which does have a split hoof, but is not a true ruminant, does not chew its cud, and it is not kosher as well. Let me also clarify that the term kosher is a generic English term that's used. The term in Hebrew would be behema tehora, a pure animal, and behema tamea, a defiled animal. Tame and tahor are used in other contexts, slightly different meaning, but you have behema and you have chaya. Behema is a domesticated animal, chaya is a wild animal, and those are the mammals. A mammal is either a behema or a chaya, or question mark whether it is one or the other, and tahora and tamea. The three types of behema tahora, kosher domesticated animal, are the cow, goat, and sheep. An example of a domesticated animal that's not kosher would be the pig or the horse. And then you have chaya tahora, the kosher non-domesticated animals, the wild animals, would be like a mountain goat and antelope of various types. And an example of an animal that's not domesticated and not kosher, take your pick, the zoos are filled with them, and the world is filled with them. So, you have that. Then you have the question of, after knowledge of cow, goat, and sheep, deer, and the antelope, and never a discouraging word, you have the newer things that came up. For example, it is now well established that giraffe is kosher. Rav Aryeh Kaplan in the Living Torah translates the zemer mentioned in Parshat Re'eh as the giraffe. A giraffe has a split hoof. You could see that when you visit him at the zoo. And a giraffe also has the necessary chambers in his stomach to be a true ruminant, and he chews its cud. This was determined by actual autopsy, or whatever it's called in case of an animal, of a giraffe that had died at the biblical zoo. A friend of mine was present during that procedure to actually be able to physically examine the stomach. This does not mean that giraffe meat is available kosher. I don't know if anybody eats giraffe meat. And it's also a nonsensical idea that it's not done because we don't know where ritual slaughter would be because of its long neck. You might need a cherry picker if it's standing up, or you have to flip it upside down, whatever. But there are 7 vertebrae in the neck of the animal, all mammals, and in the giraffe they're just bigger and longer, and it would be easier to determine between which 2 vertebrae to do shechita. And I've never heard it done. So, again, I don't know if people in Africa eat giraffe meat, but if it would properly be properly slaughtered, then we would be able to also. So much. Now, there's also a relative of the giraffe named an okapi that is also kosher. And there are various deers and antelopes which have not been studied close enough, well enough, to be determined whether they are or are not. Had a discussion with someone about the mouse deer, which is a very, very small deer, whether it is a true ruminant or its hoof is actually split the way it would make an animal acceptable as kosher. But these are things that if the need ever comes, we can determine them in the proper manner through experts that we have in both zoology and in rabbinics. Then the Torah discusses fish. Before fish. There is a prohibition against eating non-kosher meat. There is also a mitzvat aseh, a positive command, which in the language of the Torah is zot hachaya asher tochlu. This is the animal which you shall eat. That does not mean that you have to eat it. It means you have to check for the kashrut of an animal before you eat it. And extending that, not from Torah law, but extending it by the logic and the reason, we have to examine the kashrut of everything that we eat. I want it clear, I'm going beyond the scope of the Torah command here to the spirit of the law, as indicated by the fact that each of the prohibitions of the forbidden animals in each category come with a positive command of this you shall eat. And since we don't interpret this you shall eat as you have to eat meat, you don't. We interpret it, or it is taught to us, as a command requiring checking. Let me give you the example with fish. Fish are kosher if they have scales and fins. Not just any scales, but scales that can easily be scraped off without damage to the underlying skin. And there are many, many types of fish that are kosher. Picture the following scenario. Guy is at the river, and he's fishing, so have a bunch of other guys. He's by himself, he catches this beautiful looking fish, and he skins it, and fillets it, and grills it right at the riverside, and has himself a delicious supper. He's got salad that he brought with him, and drinks, and he had a wonderful supper. He's sitting now in the dusk of the evening, and a friend passes by and said, "Any luck today?" "Oh yeah, I caught this beautiful fish. In fact, I just finished it. It was delicious." "What kind was it?" "I don't know." "Was it kosher?" "Oi, I didn't even check." He rummages through the garbage bag and he finds the skin. And sure enough, fins are there and so are scales. And he tests it and they're easily scraped off. Yes, it was kosher. Okay, he realizes after the fact that he did not violate the Torah by eating a fish that doesn't have scales. But he did not fulfill the positive command to check. The language of the Torah when it comes to this, et ze tochlu mikol asher b'mayim. This you shall eat, or these you shall eat from everything that is in the water. Kol asher lo snapir v'kaskeset b'mayim, b'yamim uv'anachalim otam tochelu. Anything with scales and fins, you shall eat. Again, you don't want to eat fish, don't eat fish. The Torah is not commanding us to eat fish. The Torah is commanding us to check the kashrut of fish. As far as fish are concerned, you could find lists on the internet of kosher fish and non-kosher fish. There are a few that are controversial. The most recent fish declared kosher was the blue marlin, which has a different looking scale from all kosher fish. And for a while it was thought it was not acceptable, but it cleared many, many poskim who were actually given a sample of the skin and the meat and saw that it was an acceptable snapir v'kaskeset. We're running out of time, so let me briefly continue. When it comes to birds, there are 20-plus types of birds that are mentioned. The problem is our inaccuracy in identifying the Torah's terminology for non-kosher birds, because that's all it speaks about. It doesn't tell us what birds are kosher. It tells us these are the birds that are not kosher. And the problem is we don't have accurate definitions, plus we don't have accurate related birds families, which don't necessarily match our species and families and genii and stuff like that. So we go by tradition. We have a tradition that chicken is kosher, it's kosher. Pigeon and dove is kosher, it's kosher. There are people who have done research in finding more and more of the kosher birds. They need a tradition from Shochtim of previous generations and word of mouth, and they're compiling it. Really short of time. The fourth category is insects. There are 4 or 8 types of locust which are kosher. The rest of the insect world are not kosher. Most Jews do not have a identification of the kosher types of locust. Some Yemenites claim they do, and we'll have to leave that for a future Sanhedrin to evaluate. On that note, the best I could do is wish you a Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameah.